and welcome to today's Continued Conversation, the podcast of the International Academy for Leadership, or IAF by its German acronym. Today, we continue a conversation we began during COVID in an online seminar on smart cities and beyond. Back then, we talked about transaction costs and the sharing economy. Today, we want to talk about a different topic. We would love to explore with our guests state capacity and government efficiency, topics that are way more important than chainsaw symbolism and the names of Javier Milei and Elon Musk. I'm Bettina Solinger, and I'm the head of the IAF. As always, I'm joined by Sven Gerst, a philosopher, political thinker, and longstanding facilitator for IAF. Welcome, Sven. How are you today? And who joins us to continue our conversation?
I'm very well today, Bettina, and I'm very excited for today's conversation because the guest that we are hosting today is not only somebody I very much look up to academically, but also somebody who brought me to the United States at one point, to North Carolina, to let me experience the deep south. Well, I don't know how deep south North Carolina is after all of the United States. And I think that gave me a better perspective of how to think about the US, because sometimes we are really caught up in our European bubble and in our European way of thinking about the United States, which often doesn't relate to how the United States are actually shaping up. So, Mike, thanks for joining. And as usual, we let the guests introduce themselves because you have many hats on. So, Mike, who are you?
I'm Mike Munger. I'm a professor of political science and economics at Duke University, where I have been for nearly 30 years. I'm a past president of the Public Choice Society. I'm a past editor of the journal Public Choice. And my experience in graduate school was my PhD's in economics, but I'm a failed economist. I've really never had a job in an economics department. But I have found political science to be a very good place for the sort of work that I do, because I'm actually more interested in theories of government and limits of government than I am in the study of markets per se. I'm interested in political economy.
And that is, I think, a great angle to look at the discussion around government efficiency and the so-called Ministry for Doge. And when people hear the word Doge, they immediately think of Elon Musk nowadays, because he coined the term. And what Elon is great at is really coining the language that we work with. However, if I look at the recent discourse around government spending and government limitation, we cannot ignore the case of Javier Milei in Argentina, because I think they put that on the agenda of global liberals again, and they inspired Elon to take this project on. I mean, there's the famous moment where Javier Milei is giving the golden chainsaw to Elon Musk, somewhat ridiculous in the aesthetics, but I leave that to our listeners to judge. But from there on, people talked a little bit more about Javier Milei's government and his Minister for State Transformation, Federico Sturzenegger, that we also covered in this podcast before in our episode on Javier Milei. So my question to you, Mike, is, do you follow the events and processes of the Argentinian government and Javier Milei and how they are transforming the state in Argentina?
I've always followed the events in Argentina. A lot of my work has been in Chile. Most summers, there are winters, I go to Chile for close to a month. I'm not going to go this year. And of course, Argentina has an enormous long border with Chile, and I've always been interested in Chile. I bridle at your claim that it was a ridiculous presentation. I have a 30 centimeter tall action figure of Javier Milei con su motosierra. So he's got his chainsaw. So that is one of my, I don't have it here today. I wish I could show it, because it's a wonderful action, bobblehead action figure.
Maybe it's my European aesthetics that just kick in there. You know, like we are a bit more backseated and more modest in such approaches, I would say.
No, it is your liberal aesthetic. You are committed to losing politically, as all liberals are.
That is also true. That is very much true in the German context, I must say.
Our difficulty is that we have to commit to the fact that you need evocative visual images, and the motosierra is an excellent one. So what happened was that Argentina is in such bad shape that people were willing to accept even extreme measures. Another thing that's important is that, for better or worse, mostly for worse, I would say, Argentina has concentrated so much power in the person of the president and the executive branch that it is possible for Milei to do things that simply aren't possible in the United States. And so I think Musk, maybe to his credit in a way, just hadn't spent 10 minutes reading the U.S. Constitution and honestly believed he would be able to act like Milei. It was never true. It was hopeless. I did an econ talk with Russ Roberts in January before the inauguration and said that there's no way this can work. And we talked a little bit about Milei, and Russ, to his credit, it was charming, was very optimistic. There's no way that this could be accomplished. However, let's say what Milei did do. Argentina had a very persistent inflation, and it was clear that it was unsolvable. Milei solved it. It's down to 1.5% per month, which is very impressive. There was immediately, in the first part of the shock treatment, there was a very substantial recession and an increase in poverty that has turned around. They now have economic growth. And maybe most important, one of the things that Argentina was facing was a complete destruction of all of its foreign currency reserves. And they were having to place capital controls in order to prevent people from taking capital out of the country. That's a terrible idea, but as a last resort, you may have to do it. Milei has managed to reduce government spending by 30%, actually did reduce government spending by 30%, which is an enormous amount. And the result has been that the IMF has been willing to make loans, extend credit. They're starting to get more investment. And so as a result, the books are now more or less balanced. They have growth. They have solved the problem of inflation, at least for now. It is one of the great economic success stories of the 21st century.
And I think a big part of the success of Javier Milei's government is due to Federico Sturzenegger's work in the Ministry for State Transformation. I think it always has a one-year mandate, and that needs to be expanded by executive order by the president. But every day, I think the minister walks in and looks at the calendar and sees how many days are left to do so. So they publish on their Twitter account every day how much regulation they cut. So, for example, one legislation a day or something like that. And that is very successful in the Argentinian case. And it's a success story that you outlined. Now, why doesn't it work in the United States? Because we are talking right now, after a little bit of an episode of a fallout between Trump and Elon, and it certainly seems clear at this point that the whole Doge project of Elon Musk is a complete and utter failure. So what worked in Argentina as a blueprint didn't work in the United States. And you said you were not hopeful from the start. Why did you be so pessimistic? Why were you so pessimistic?
There were two reasons. First, when you say that there's a falling out, there's not a falling out. This is a high school girl fight. They're grabbing each other's hair. They're shrieking. They're hitting each other with their shoes. It's embarrassing. And so the two reasons were that I thought that it was impossible for the executive branch to get the authority that it would need either to cut regulations, which are statutory. They have the force of statutes. They cannot be changed unilaterally without the permission of Congress. And the other is that Elon Musk, unsurprisingly, is a business person. He has the attention span of a gnat. He expects to be able to give orders and have it followed and go on to the next thing. And he tried on their website to say, we've cut this, we've cut this, we've cut this. Within a couple of weeks, it was clear none of it was true. None of it was true. There were basically no cuts. He also made another mistake, which you might say is a third category. Milei said, we're going to cut government spending. Musk said, we're going to cut waste, fraud, and abuse. There's no budget item that says waste, fraud, and abuse. Unless you think all government is waste, fraud, and abuse, you have a problem. And so there was an almost immediate kickback. There's a bunch of regulations that have to be enforced. And so there's an example. Suppose I have applied for a license, or I have asked for permission for government to do something. I have to have that before I can go on with my business. What Musk did was manage to lay off all the workers who were processing those requests. the requests were unchanged. He couldn't get rid of the law that said you have to have the government's permission. You have to say Simon Says, government, can I please do this? And unless you get the permission of the government, you're stuck. Laying off those people is worse than this. And they ended up bringing them back anyway. So there was just a fundamental misunderstanding of the differences between the two forms of government. Now, I prefer ours. Argentina's had a bunch of problems with concentrated power in the presidency. But if you want to make big changes, you have to have concentrated power in the presidency. I think Trump doesn't fully understand that. He's often trying to do things he simply cannot do. But Musk was completely confused about what was possible. And not surprisingly, having the attention span of a gnat, he quit. And then started, I think rightly, criticizing Trump. I have also the increase in the deficit. He reverted to concern about the deficit, not let's cut government spending. Let's worry about the deficit. Nobody cares about the deficit. You need the motosierra. We're going to cut government, not lower the deficit. Nobody cares. They should, but they don't.
I mean, it sounds to me that there is a fundamental misalignment in what Musk wanted to focus on. He really wanted to focus on government spending and finding these alleyways for fraud. And for them, fraud, I think, is very politically loaded because they have a conception that, for example, DEI measures and stuff like that, that is immediately fraud, you know? So there is a political agenda behind a lot of these things. And when Musk initially came to his position, I was already skeptical because it looked to me that they are first going after political enemies, so to speak. And that is always the most dangerous form of putting somebody into political power. And that's what they did with USAID. And that's what they did with a lot of other government agencies that they then in the end rehire. But because he was so focused on government spending alone and not on the whole system of the bureaucratic regulatory state, I think he targeted just the wrong things. I mean, that's my interpretation, and I want to hear your thoughts in a second. For me, he just targeted the wrong things. For example, when he said, to avoid fraud and abuse of government spending, I say every expense on a credit card of the government above $1 has to be justified. So he implements more layers of regulation because now every transaction has to be somehow reviewed. And then somebody else has to review that, which needs additional personnel, right? So I think from a business perspective, I understand what he's focusing on. He wants to really look at the budget lines, but the regulatory state is a different beast. Would you agree with that assessment that coming out of business, you might just not understand and how to tackle the regulatory bureaucratic state, no matter the political situation? Because in Argentina, we have a trained economist in that position with Federico Sturzenegger, right? He's an MIT-trained economist. He understands political economy, while Elon Musk is a business person and therefore comes in and looks at budget lines he looks at it in Tesla or SpaceX. And I think that just gave them the wrong start from the beginning. So what do you think of this take?
Let me take a step back. You're so right that I have to explain a little bit why you're right, because you're kind of starting in the middle. What's required is a theory of government. You have to have a theory about what it is the government should do before you start to compare what government is actually doing. And Musk's theory of government seemed to be that anything government does is wasteful. Well, And what we'll do is we'll cut it by 10%.
Isn't that very libertarian?
Don't get me started. Yes. So in 2008, I was the keynote speaker at the Libertarian National Convention, the U.S. party in Denver, Colorado, thousands of libertarians in one room. So it's like the bar scene in Mos Eisley. You know, there's a blue person, somebody with two heads, a very odd group of people. And I got to give my talk, and my talk is, what are we for? And it fell dead born from the press. No one wanted to hear that. They just wanted to be against things. So my question is for libertarians, for liberals, whoever is listening to this podcast, what are you for? What is your theory of government? What should government be doing? And if you think government should be doing nothing, that's fair enough. That's weird. Nobody else believes that. And so the big problem that I see is that we need to have advance a theory of what the state should do. Now, in Musk's case, I said he should put two books in front of him. One is the U.S. Constitution and the 10th Amendment, which says that everything that the states do, the federal government cannot do. And then Milton Friedman's Free to Choose, and that would say anything that markets can do, government should not be doing. And so I'm a state capacity libertarian. I think the things that the state should do, it should do well, those should be well-funded. We just have to decide what those are. What has happened is there's been a proliferation of government activities into many things it should not be doing. Cutting all of that, what it should do and what it shouldn't do by 10% is a disaster. What we need to do is cut 100% of the things that it should not be doing. But for that, you need a theory of the state. What is the justification for the state? What are the proper functions of the state?
Yeah, and I think that also for our audience to shine some light on what is the theory of the state we are talking here about, which we are talking here right now, or the liberal theory or classical liberal in our liberal European liberal sense of the thing.
That's the correct one. The Americans stole it. They should give it back.
Yeah, we asked, they didn't.
Well, they believe in property rights when it comes to their own stuff.
So what kind of theory of the state would you roughly put point at for to also be able to understand the different concepts and also to evaluate where things could lead or what should be avoided to do?
Bettina, the thing is, we've never talked about that. What frustrates me, so I want to bang my head against the wall. We have been duped into playing a sucker's game by the left. What we all do is celebrate the perfection of markets. And then we allow them to criticize markets, and we end up arguing a fight we're going to lose. Markets aren't perfect. What we need to do is compare two imperfect institutions, markets and the state. And so Pete Betke tells a story about a minstrel's competition. I, being a redneck from the American South, I prefer a pretty pig contest. So we have these big agricultural fairs. The North Carolina, the state where I live, the North Carolina State Fair, they have competitions from livestock. And so adult pigs are not pretty, but one day they say, we're going to have an adult pig contest. So they bring out the first pig. There's only two. They bring out the first pig. And the judges look at it, and it's got one tooth coming up here. It's all covered with mud. It's smelly. And the judge says, oh, that's really ugly. Let's just give the prize to the other pig. We don't even have to look at the other pig. We'll just give the prize to the other pig. That's the game that liberals have been losing. We bring out the ugly pig, the market, and say, look how beautiful it is. Well, it's not. There's a bunch of problems with it. We let the left say, ah, and therefore government. And so the story is we have a well-developed theory of market failure, and it is a government failure not to fix market failures. That's their only definition of government failure, is the failure to correct, to improve, to Pareto optimality, all of the things that markets fail to do. That's a terrible definition of government failure. So in 2015, a Duke colleague of mine, William Keach, and I published a paper called The Anatomy of Government Failure. So we tried to make a lengthy argument about all of the ways that government fails, because what we've allowed the left to do is compare markets as they are to the state they can imagine. And everyone can imagine a really good state. States as they are, however, are much worse. And then what happens is that the left says, oh, we need better people. We need institutional reform. No, it is a per se feature of the state to have fundamental failures. And so paradoxically, what liberals need to do is have a theory of the state that allows them to say, here's why imperfect markets are better than even more imperfect state in certain domains. However, there are some domains where we might want to depend on the state. I have found that if you talk that way to leftists, they're completely disarmed. Oh, I just thought you wanted to get rid of the government. I'm not an anarchist. You are probably not a communist, my leftist friend. There are some things that we know. What we need to do is argue and decide what is the correct domain for the state. And the problem is state power tends to metastasize. States, in order to be able to do what they need to do, need powers to do things that they should not be doing. And we need to have constitutional restrictions to pin them up in the domain that we as a polity have decided. So that's the problem. And liberals never talk about that. We just say, oh, look, markets are beautiful.
But let me push back on one thing, and that is that liberals have no theory of the state. I mean, they just have a theory of government failure all over the place. I mean, public choice theory, Hayekian knowledge problems, these are all theories that you can apply and say, well, That's why the central planner or the state, because of its incentive structures, cannot deliver and will have something like cronyism and whatnot, right? So we have a very negative conception of government failure itself. However, then the more positive notion how this could be reformed into an institution that could deliver on its core promises, I think we lack. And maybe one thing I want to say as a political philosopher, we have theories of the state. Like, I think most political philosophers have focused on what should be the extent of government be, right? If we look at Robert Nozick, the Night Watchman state, if we look at Milton Friedman, and even if we look at Hayek's The Constitution of Liberty, he
James
has
Buchanan.
James Buchanan, yes. And we have a conception of the state. But what maybe frustrates me is that these are very abstract state of nature definitions of the state and limitations. But how to turn back an existing regulatory state or how to deal with a bureaucracy, I think we need to spend more time on defining that and maybe conceptually understanding it. Maybe the closest that I know that comes to that is Ludwig van Mises in his treatise on bureaucracy, where he tries to tackle the problem. But do you see within the liberal canon that there is an effort to really have a fully fleshed out theory of what the modern 2025 government should be? I understand where Robert Nozick comes from, but this is political abstract ideal philosophy, right? The Night Watchman state. We can't just right now press the red button and roll back 80% of the state, right?
That is certainly right. I would say that what many of us do is the pretty big contest in reverse. We trot out government failures and say, look what an ugly pig government is. And therefore, there should be no government. That's completely unpersuasive. No one believes that for the reason that you just said. And so what you need is a way of parsing. What you need is what are the functions? And I agree completely about von Mises, and I have been touting that book. And in fact, in my discussions of Doge, I would say he should have read von Mises. Because what von Mises says is you can't really blame bureaucrats or bureaucracy for being inefficient. It is the nature of bureaucracy that they have to be bureaucrats have to be insulated from all the incentives because there's no profit and loss information. And so what they have to do is become expert in enforcing the rules, and their comparative advantage is actually knowing in details what the rules are and following the rule of law. The question is this a government function or not? If it is, you're going to use bureaucracy with all of the problems that come with it. If it's not, you need to use some other system because you can't reform bureaucracy and make it more efficient. So I would say, well, Mises is the starting place, and that's not where we start. We start instead by, when you say political philosophers, there's like seven of you. Seven political philosophers who are also liberals. Maybe
they don't pay well, huh?
Perhaps they don't pay enough from a social perspective, but people are not liberal political philosophers for the money. I'm sure of that. It's because they actually believe in it. That's not persuasive to other people. What I see over, and because I run for office every even numbered year. I ran this past year as a libertarian for the North Carolina General Assembly. And I find by doing that, talking to people, I really learn a lot about what they care about. The people who think they agree with us think we should cut everything in government by 10%. So we're losing. That's not the right answer.
Yeah, but so maybe just to follow up, and then Bettina, you can jump in. So far, we still like circulating a little bit around the core question. What then should government do? I mean, you're a political economist. I'm a political philosopher. What should government then in the end do? If you would take over a Doge ministry, what should be the first steps to take here? And just for context for our listeners, I think Doge and this whole idea of government transformation has been incredibly popular all around the world. Even Germany, one of the slowest countries to adopt new trends, launched a ministry for digitalization and state modernization. So like even here, we have a discourse around that, but our minister, it's unclear where he's going to start. So where should we start? And even if we don't have a fully fleshed out theory, we can approach it somehow. But I don't see that in a liberal discourse, we are clear where to start.
Well, it's partly because we don't agree. And so one of the reasons we don't even know or we don't agree is that we don't usually talk about it. I would go back to, I'm a big fan of James Buchanan, and he was heavily influenced by Knut Fixell, the Swedish liberal economist Again, the set of Swedish liberal economists is very small. There's some. There may be 12. But Wicksell was very influential. And he pointed out that most of the theories that economists have about government, and you just did it, what should this one person do? And we're assuming the existence of an omniscient benevolent dictator. And this omniscient benevolent dictator will, if we can advise that person will implement the optimal policies.
I mean, we don't have to assume that. We can just say Mike Munger takes over the ministry. And that comes very close to the to the benevolent, omniscient...
Okay, so we have an old dotard in charge instead of an omniscient benevolent dictator. What we have is democracy. Liberals have to be for democracy. And so the question is, there's a big disconnect in a democratic society between two different concepts. One is public goods, and the other is things that voters think are good for the public. Economists say that what we should do is the government should produce public goods and only public goods. No one thinks that. No one thinks that. Roads are not public goods. Roads are clearly excludable. And in fact, in some of the Northern European countries, there's a lot of private or club roads that solve this problem in a way that I think Americans would be shocked by. We just assume that's something that the public should do. So we need to focus on a theory of democratic liberalism about what it is that government should do and say, make the argument that these kinds of regulations, these kinds of taxes are damaging to prosperity and to individual liberty. Because when we focus on the putting, we'll put Munger in charge and everything will be good if we can have a dictatorship for a couple of days because Munger or Guest is in charge. That's not going to happen. And when we put Musk, who's a much smarter man than I am, he just failed utterly. It is an interesting question. What would I have done? What I would have done is instead of having a shotgun approach, I would have tried a laser approach. I would have tried to have some initial successes as proof of concept. There are two government bureaucracies that clearly should not exist in the United States. One is the Department of Education and the other is the Department of Commerce. Neither of those are activities that government should be in at all. The Department of Education is because education is a state function. The Department of Commerce is just an oxymoron. You can't have a Department of Commerce. Commerce is a non-government activity. So what we should do is say we're going to approach Congress and voters and have ads and make an argument for why these two large, wasteful, damaging bureaucracies should be eliminated, zeroed out in their entirety. And if that, and I think there's no question but that would have gotten through the Republicans in Congress. If that had been done, then we would no longer have this sacrosanct idea. Robert Higgs calls it a ratchet effect. Government always gets bigger. Sometimes it doesn't grow as fast, but it always grows. If what we could do is say, we have cut out entirely two different large, expensive bureaucracies with all of their accompanying regulation. Look around you. Is the world a better place? Yes. That would mean that we would have had some momentum. So that's what Mike Munger would do if I had been in charge of DOGE, not go through a catalog of regulations I can't change and budgets that I can't reduce.
I think the second part is very important, to focus on the legislations that don't help and like cutting those this red tape, so to speak, out of the regulatory burden. But I think here DOGE shows the utter failure of comprehending this, because while Elon is going after the Ministry for Education, I think Trump puts out executive orders of what education policy should look like. And then you suddenly defund a structure that should impose certain form of legislation. That violates what you talked about earlier. When we want the government to do something, we want it well-resourced and well-structured, right? So I think the focus on legislation is exactly the right approach. And that's also something that in Argentina they are doing right. And the second point is more of a pushback to some of your earlier remarks. Are not, now it's kind of escaping me how I wanted to frame it, but like I think Bettina,
I talked so long. I'm sorry.
No, it will come back to me. It will come back to me in a second. But Bettina, maybe you can jump in there.
I think that's a very interesting place to be right now, to think about how to reduce bureaucracy and everything, because each regulation that you put into place has consequences, and then you need more regulation to somehow handle the consequences. And then we also have the information problem. Also for the legislative body, there is an information body. The information they get is from the people or from interest groups, and who shouts the loudest maybe gets an ear or more. So that's
the interesting thing about the Ludwig von Mises point, is that by definition, bureaucracies do those things that markets can't do because there's no price information to guide us. Why do we think bureaucrats will have better information? What bureaucrats have is authority and the ability to send men with guns to enforce their will. But they're very likely to get it wrong. The knowledge problem also applies to market failures. Even if you think that there's a problem of externality, let's suppose that almost all of these arguments start with externalities. The problem with externalities is that an action that I take in selling something to you affects a third party in ways that are hard for markets to measure and internalize. Bureaucrats can't measure it either. Interest groups and politically powerful entities are going to influence that, because what we've done is create an entity that can add additional taxes and subsidies. The contest to control the person of who that entity is will result in a giant rent-seeking contest. And so what we're doing is diverting. We have a problem. Externalities are a problem. I don't deny that. Saying that we're going to have a giant rent-seeking contest to allow one or the other party to reward its friends and smite its enemies using this fakery of taxes and subsidies is worse.
Yeah. And also makes it very hard for people to predict a little bit further into the future and then make their decisions on what they expect to be happening, because maybe something has been said before an election, and then after the election, you get something completely else. And are left standing in the rain with it.
Several times during. So someone famously asked Milton Friedman once, I mean, you're constantly talking about optimal taxes. What should taxes be? And Friedman immediately answered, whatever tax system we have now. Whatever tax system we have now, if I am certain it is not going to be changed, it'll be priced in. So capitalism can, now, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect, but what you're saying is we're going to create an entity that has the power to use its discretion to change taxes. It's not going to do it once. It means I have no idea what the taxes are going to be 6 months or a year from now. That's worse than almost any tax system. And we've been doing that with tariffs, regardless of what you believe about what tariffs should be. So there's three different things that the Trump administration might be trying to do. Maybe we want to reduce our dependence on China. Maybe we want to raise revenue. Maybe we want to create a giant tariff barrier so that we can have more domestic industry. Those are three different things. We're alternating, cycling among them, which means that business cannot possibly know whether they should start a new investment in the United States. It's the uncertainty. So Amity Schles, in her wonderful book, The Forgotten Man, about the Great Depression and the Roosevelt administration, one of the things she really documents well is what Roosevelt claimed we're going to engage in bold, persistent experimentation. That's a disaster for business, because I don't know what the law is, I don't know what the regulations are, and I don't know what the taxes are going to be. I can't plan. So that clearly extended the Great Depression. I'm worried that Trump is going to cause at least a recession because of this uncertainty. And Doge contributed to that. We don't know what the regulations are. Almost any fixed set of regulations is better than one that's constantly subject to a rent-seeking contest.
But that sounds awfully conservative, right? So Javier Milei and the chainsaw, that doesn't seem to work in the same way, right? Because he wants state transformation and he wants to cut things down. And that is completely and quite radically different from the approach that you just outlined.
Why did we get there? And it's because the president had the power to do that stuff in the first place. The only reason we need Malay with his chainsaw is that the president's had that power. So yes, once you have created a structure that's completely unworkable, it would be nice to have someone who can change it. And the next president will change it again and change it back. So anything fixed is going to be better. Now, it is true that Argentina was so, we started with this. Argentina was such a disaster that it actually made sense to say, look, we're going to change this. Even the Motosierra, well, that's better than this. I'm worried that the U.S. is going to adopt bold, persistent experimentation on the right, and the result is going to be just as bad as it was in the late 1930s on the left, because you have to know what you're doing. The U.S. is not in such bad shape. Much of the problems that we have with tariffs are being created by the administration. There was no disaster. We didn't have inflation. We didn't have quite the fiscal problems that Argentina had, although we are getting close.
The difference is also, that in the U.S. right now, it seems like that one of the instruments is not only to create chaos, but also to work with fear and to make people even more anxious and uncertain to manipulate or manage them. And you talked about capitalism before. I also understood that when you talk to Ross Roberts, that you see democracy needs capitalism and vice versa, in a way, that both systems are flawed, but they need each other. But ultimately, they will also destroy each other because it leads to cronyism. It leads to a lot of problems. There is also already justified criticism on the capitalism we see in most countries around the world. It's not flawless, and it's not, we just need to do it better. But there is also a context in which it is placed. So, and this context, if it's a democracy, is also not an easy one. So how would you describe or maybe elaborate a little bit it's not bad people who do that, but there are incentives, there are rational choices made by the politicians, but also by the by businesses and entrepreneurs. But those rational choices makes them wise, but it doesn't make them good. And at the end, we end up in a not so good state of a country.
The difficulty we have is, and you said democracy, and I said democracy, there are no examples of democracy working at scale. It always becomes authoritarian. What we mean is republics. And a republic is a constitutional system in which certain activities are by the Constitution assigned to majorities, and some things are denied to majorities. There are some things that majorities cannot do. They can't take private property. They can't restrict speech. So the best example is the U.S. Bill of Rights, but most countries that survive are republics, and they have representative bodies that are elected according to certain rules. And it may be that a majority of the population wants something, but that's not delivered by the legislature because it happens at a more elite, refined level. Now, many people are upset about that and think that we need democracy. I am a liberal, and so I tend to think that democracy is two wolves and a sheep deciding what's for lunch. And it always goes bad for the sheep. And so what we need is a rule. We can have that, but one of the rules is you can't eat each other. That makes it a republic. That's not a democracy anymore. We're not deciding things by majority rule. We are imposing rules that say there are certain things that majorities cannot do no matter how fervently they want them. And that's a very difficult line to sustain because ultimately, and this was James Buchanan's observation, it is majorities that decide what those rules are. So we say, here's a rule that says majorities can't do that. And then majorities say, well, we'd actually like to change that, please. Well, it's really hard to prevent that because there is a majoritarian thrust. It can slow it down a lot. So if we think of this as a problem of republics, then the solution is to restrict the ability of market actors to gain control over the state and to restrict the ability of state actors to sell public policy to the highest bidder. If you can do those two things, that is, you have a separation between concentrated economic power and concentrated political power. Because without that barrier, concentrated economic power is likely to metastasize, to cross the boundary. And that, I think, is a legitimate criticism of Elon Musk. He spent hundreds of millions of dollars in support of Donald Trump. And so we have the idea that U.S. presidential elections will be decided by the people. Well, it sort of isn't, because we have the Electoral College. But there's this one person whose vote apparently counts a whole lot more because he has a lot of money. The difficulty with that argument, and the reason that I'm impatient with it, is that Kamala Harris spent nearly twice as much money as Donald Trump. Money is not as important in elections as it once was. What matters is your ability to use social media and probably to misrepresent the views of your opponent. And so we're actually devolving. I've been working on this a bit. The last time this happened at such a level was when the invention of the printing press allowed the creation of these anonymous pamphlets, which basically destroyed all of the existing authoritative sources of information. Now, that's good. Some of these were the church that was using it in a way that was wrong. Some of it were government censors, and you could get around government censors. But it took 100 years to start to get new sources of authoritative information. You weren't sure. And so I worry that we're in for, if not 100 years, some decades of extremely confused elections where what used to matter, which was money and the ability to advertise and give more or less correct information about my positions, is going to be taken over by the ability to create deep fake videos that will just propagate themselves. And that means that we're likely to get, people have sympathy. People want to believe that we will empower a strong, and it's man usually, a strong man to do the right thing. We are going to, I have a story where I have been denied something, and this Messiah is going to rise up and restore me to my place of honor and is going to put down those people who have oppressed me. This lends itself to demagoguery about race, about religion. I worry that we're in for a bad time of it because we've lost the authority that used to prevent money from mattering in politics. Now it's going to matter in new ways that we don't understand or have control of.
Well, I might have a different take on that. I think for me, it's more the earlier point that you made, and that from a political economy perspective, is that democracy, even liberal democracy, and that's what I understand as what you call the republic, majoritarian rule limited by the rule of law and human rights, broadly conceived. That's what we usually talk about when we talk about liberal democracy, that this seems to be not a stable equilibrium. Now, the case seems to be that in a liberal democracy, even if the rule of law is established and rights are protected, it still gives a lot of leeway for the populace to decide on things to make the regulatory state to expand. One thing, of course, the obvious question is the welfare state, but all other sorts of things that happen in our society. Because we live still in a world where the Leviathan is the person to address when something goes wrong, right? And not the markets, private individuals, or civil society, right? And there, it's very hard to put a constitutional limit on what the state could do, unless you have a real theory of what the state should do, right? So liberal democracy expands the regulatory bureaucratic state continuously. And at one point, everybody feels, okay, we reached a tipping point. The state is so inefficient, we need radical reform. And a radical reform is nowadays promised, and here we have real world data, by the so-called populists. So what are the populists? Our listeners will know. They are illiberal Democrats, right? They want to emphasize the majoritarian element in this trifecta of rule of law, human rights, and majoritarian rule. They want to go after the rule of law, speaking executive orders and the like, but in general, like going after the courts, what we see in the US, but in Hungary, in Turkey, in India, and many other places. And they go after rights, especially of minorities or civil society and whatnot, right? So is it an inherent feature of liberal democracies that we lead to this cycle? It's less or so that, oh, money plays a role or social media. For me, it's a question of political economy. How stable is the current equilibrium of liberal democracy without our earlier point of a substantiated theory of the state enforced by constitutional limits?
I really regret doing this because I try never to cite Hegel. But
oh, yeah. you are opening the right doors here. I open ears.
I have to cite Hegel. It's not an equilibrium. It's a dialectic. And so that is
music to my ears.
So what we have seen is that in the 1930s and 40s, all was lost. Things were far worse in terms of concentrated power than they are now in almost every country. And in the post-World War II era, it was clear that operating a wartime economy in peacetime was the right way to do it. Friedrich von Hayek despaired. And in 1944, he wrote The Road to Serfdom. In the period after, in 1947, he established the Mont-Pelerin Society in an attempt to say, you know, there's few remnant of people. We have to wait until people come to their senses. And a lot of people said, this is terrible. We're on their own. Voters were convinced partly by the arguments that liberals made, but also partly by the example of how badly this worked. And so we came a long way back. And ultimately, 1993, Francis Fukuyama wrote that it was the end of history. We no longer need even to consider these alternatives. They're just gone. And liberal democracy and capitalism is an indissoluble bond, and all nations will become that. Well, both Hayek in 1944 and Fukuyama in 1993 were wrong, because it's not an equilibrium, it's a dialectic. Now, that's very frustrating, but it does mean that it is precisely when all hope seems lost that it is most likely that the efforts of liberals can begin to have an effect. So there's a bit of hope there.
Although it must make me hopeful about current times, because a dialectical approach means we are currently in the antithesis to liberal democracy, so to speak, and that yes. can go on for a long while, as we know. And however, I mean, let's be hopeful and maybe pivot to something that we can learn from this. If we are currently in the antithesis to liberal democracy, it maybe pushes liberals to really think about their conception of the state. And I think you and Tyler Cowen have coined the term of state capacity and repopularized kind of a new discourse. And for our audience, I think Tyler wrote 2 or 3 years ago about state capacity. I think you followed up with some other pieces on that particular wording, even in the Public Choice Society. I heard you talked about state capacity, which is not the most friendly audience for such discourses, I assume. And there are some substacks even now talking about state capacity and state crafting the modern state. So what do you mean when you talk about state capacity? How would you introduce it to our audience?
There's two aspects. One is, I think our theory of the government should be Humean and not Lockean. Hume's theory of government was that it exists, it's a convention, it's the status quo, we're all used to it. We didn't consent, but we all agree, and let's go from there. James Buchanan actually wrote a series of papers on the status quo where he said we have to accept the status quo. And so George Vanberg and I had a piece in Public Choice where we argued that understanding this correctly means that we should be contractarians at the margin. So we accept the status quo. And then what we try to do is insist on the use of consent for any change to the status quo. So we don't allow unilateral changes by powerful people. We try to control populism, because populism is the voluntary empowering of a strong person to make these changes. It means that the changes are more likely to be incremental. And we have to go to the work of persuading people, here is our theory of the state. It should be a rebuttable presumption that things should be in the private sector, that we're better off. And by private sector, this is the contestable. This is the simplest way I can put it. Who owns Tocqueville? Many people who are liberals would say that there's markets and the state. And I've often gotten this criticism. Well, Ludwig von Mises said there's only markets in the state. Well, there's one quote where he said that, but if you read the context, that's not what von Mises meant. there's a big voluntary sector of nonprofit groups, churches, clubs. Those are the things that James Buchanan was writing about. Those are the things that Tocqueville was writing about. We own those. Those are the things that we should use to accomplish a lot of these collective goals. And I mentioned before, clubs, club roads, local activities that we can have that are, they're not the state. The advantage of a club is that we pool our resources and we can kick people out if they don't pay their dues because it's excludable. There's many so-called public goods that are like that. So if that is our theory of the state, if that's what we can advance, what we want is a rebuttable presumption in favor of private action that puts the burden of the proof, a burden of proof, on whomever wants to say, you know, the state should do this. Because when you say the state should do this, I propose that this should be called the Munger test, because I'm an arrogant person. The Munger test is whenever one of my friends on the left says, you know, the state should do that. I say, wait, stop. Take out the state and put in Donald Trump. Do you still believe it? Because they have this idea that the state is this thing they can imagine. The state is actual people. And the more you empower the state, the more you are giving a very sharp sword to your worst enemy. So you should never give a sword so large and powerful you don't want to see it wielded against you immediately following the next election. And that, I think, is the argument. That's the rebuttable presumption part. If you think this is so important that you want the bad guys to have this power, go ahead. But there's no state. There's no such thing as the state. What there is, and that's the difficulty that we have, is there is an abstraction called the state. We have to have a theory of it. But we have to recognize that control of that power is not the same as the power itself. We create these powers, but we lose the control of it. Do you still want the state to do that?
Yeah, I mean, when we look in a lot of Western democracies and who are economically quite in a good position compared to how life has been 100 years ago in Germany, in the US, and so on, or more than 100 years ago, it seems that at that time people much more trusted in their own ability to solve their problems and have been, maybe in a way also have been educated out of that trust in themselves and their responsibility, with a good intention, but with a bad result. And nowadays, I sometimes have the impression that for many people, the state is more equivalent to Amazon than to any bureaucracy, because they want something or need something and then they order it, and if they don't get it, they get angry and complain and so on. But the idea to maybe solve their problems themselves is for many a very strange ideas. And if you take it even further, it's sometimes impossible because you're not allowed to solve your problem yourself. You have to turn to some state agency or, you know, ask for it with a form and three copies of it and I don't know what. So there's also this strange conception of what a state is also for even politically interested people.
Tocqueville predicted that in a way that's eerie. So in Democracy in America, he said that one of the interesting things about the United States is that if they see a school that's falling down or something that doesn't work, they form an association and say, let's fix it. In France, as early as 1830, if the school wasn't working, they'd say the state should do something. Well, if it becomes the responsibility of a non-existent entity to fix this, then it is unlikely, because what's going to happen is that there will be contests of power and some get rewarded and some don't. I saw I think that you've put your finger on something that is a really important problem. I don't know the answer, but we should start with that. It is not the state's business. And in fact, the state is not capable of insulating you from all risk. So there were just some very enormous floods in Texas recently, and there was a camp, a summer camp for young women, and almost 100 people were killed at that camp. One of the mothers said, why do I even pay taxes when things like this can happen? Well, what happened was that a rainstorm that had half a meter of rain that was not predicted happened within 12 hours. What could the state possibly do about that? The idea that that's the state's responsibility, that's the stage that we're at. And so we ask the state to do things it is less and less capable of doing. And we try to expand its capacity to do those things at the cost of doing the things that it should be doing. There are, in fact, public goods. There is a federal court system. There is a system of federal laws that need to be enforced. We've gotten to the point where in order to, if you have a case at the federal level, it may be 9 months, 12 months before a trial date is even scheduled because things are so backed up. The Italian system, it's 3 or 4 years. There are many countries that have, there are so many things that have to be adjudicated. There are so many things that have to be decided by the state that we are wasting a lot of resources just in the process of deciding. I often have this argument with judges. I do classes with the Law and Economics Center at the Scalia School at George Mason. So we will talk to federal judges to teach them about economics. And their concern is often, well, how do I make the right decision? That's not the right question. The right question is, how do we have no cases?
While you were talking, or while Bettina raised her question, I remember that the German word for all of this kind of statism, like to delegate everything to the state, even has the French name in it. So we say étatisme, so from, you know, the French état. So that's just a fun fact on the side.
Well, Germans also call the municipal building the Rathaus, which I think anyone that calls the municipal building the Rathaus is, you've got something going for you.
Yeah, we have a good conception of the state, ask our friend Hegel. But I wanted to ask one thing about state capacity on a more conceptual level again. State capacity, of course, is about the limits of what the state should do, but it is also that it should then do it well, right? And we know when do markets work well, when we leave it to the spontaneous order of the people. But for the state, what it means to carry out things well needs, again, harder thought. What do you mean in the state capacity discourse when you say, oh, these tasks are for the state and it has to carry it out well-funded in a well manner and with well processes? What kind of conceptual angle do you have there?
I have a kind of bias. I have an embarrassing secret from my past. I was the dean of the public administration program at UNC Chapel Hill for quite a few years. And we trained city, county managers and people who were going to work for state and federal bureaucracies. And the idea that when you teach, these people are going to be in bureaucracies, they need to be experts. They need to have credentials. They need to have a sense of belonging to a guild that has certain moral and ethical obligations. And they need to be well paid. Those jobs need to be competitive. And losing that job would actually mean something. If they violate the rules of the guild, it would actually mean something. What's happened in the United States is that year on year, when I first got out of graduate school, I worked at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission in the first Reagan administration on trade policy. And government economists made more money than academic economists. Now, government economists make about half what academic economists make if they get a kind of top level job. So the result is, and you see this in books about finance also, the regulators are the people who couldn't get real jobs because the level of prestige, the amount of pay, these are people who don't want to have to work for a living and will have job security. And they're willing to trade off against that any sort of ambition or competence. All they have to do is not get fired and eventually they'll get their pensions. So we need to shrink and elevate those activities that we think government should be engaging in and go back to the point where this is actually still true to in large measure in Germany, France, and Japan, where the top level federal bureaucrats, it's really true in France and Japan. They are seen as being very important. They go to the best schools. It's true in India also. They go to the best schools. They get good pay. These are jobs that everybody wants. That's not true in the United States because we have so many different overworked people who actually can't carry out their functions, and so we don't pay them very much.
Do you know any countries where there are some good things to look at?
France and Japan. The problem is that in France and Japan, and this has always been true in France, the person who you hire as your artillery officer, Napoleon notwithstanding, but except in wartime, the people who are elevated to offers are the ones who go to the best écoles, not the ones that have experience and know how to actually accomplish things. And so in France, it's the people who get the best grades in engineering, but still, there is a contest. This is seen as something that you actually want to do, and in order to keep this job, you have to perform. You have to do things reasonably well. So the United States, the worst thing that you can have is an expansion of responsibilities, and then the feeling that, well, they're no good at this because we're asking them to do things they couldn't do in the first place. We might as well just cut them by 10% because it won't cost us anything. So I would say France and Japan are pretty good models for having a bureaucracy that is well respected. The problem is we have to do the first step first, and that is get rid of all the functions that government shouldn't be doing in the first place. So it's a sequence. We have to impose the rebuttable presumption this should be done in the private sector or by Tocquevillian voluntary private associations. And these will spring up if we get rid of the government undergrowth that is preventing people from acting on their impulse to associate privately, that makes people think, oh, the government should fix that. I pay taxes. The government should protect me from all risk. That's a disaster. I don't know how you change it, but that's the first thing you have to change.
Yeah, I mean, also France is very centralized. So you might have great bureaucrats, but the system is still pretty flawed when you limit.
They haven't done the first step. The government does too many things.
Exactly. But are there examples for a good provision of public goods with a good use of state capacity, not too much? Like, I don't know, many people point to Estonia or Taiwan.
Finland. Yeah, I think the answer
can
is...
Can we learn from them?
And I'm a Kosian on this question. And so what we need to do is reduce the transactions cost of people coming together. And so one of the things that I have worked on a little bit, and there was some experimentation with this in Estonia, but it didn't really work, but it's possible. But suppose you think of local public goods. You have a small town. When I lived in Germany, I lived in Erlangen, which is just north of Nuremberg. Northwest of a short train
Most
ride.
Most prosperous region for our audience, huh?
A very pleasant place to live. And it was a small enough town. They have a public works department, and the perception was that the public works was not very close to being in touch with what it was that the people wanted because it was very bureaucratic. What you could do is create an app where I go on my phone and I can enter a thing that I think should be done by the Public Works Department. And it would work like a bridal registry. A bridal registry in the United States, at least, is something that the couple wants. So there would be this list of things that the Public Works Department should do. There's a pothole here. This street sign is broken. This bush needs to be trimmed. And then people could make bids on this app by saying that I would like my tax dollars to go to this, and you would get information about the priority. So you learn what are the things that people want and what are they actually willing to pay for. And then those jobs could be privately contracted out. We don't need a public goods department. A public works department. We will have those jobs privately contracted out by something like it's like eBay or the Angie's List. So this is a list of jobs. So instead of a public works department, you could have a private app, but it would be understood that I owe a certain amount of taxes to the city every year, and the money that is spent on the public works that I want done will count against that. And if I do nothing, I'll just have to pay my taxes in the usual way. So Estonia actually experimented with this a little bit. Local public works are not public goods. It is, and crucially, we solve the free rider problem by none of the tasks implement. All of the money is held in escrow until everyone has satisfied their obligation. And so we can overcome the free rider problem. I don't have to worry about the fact that I'll be spending and no one else will, because the money will not be spent until everyone has picked something. And so the public goods and the free rider problem are technological problems. They're not per se. These are things that we can overcome with technology. And so I wonder if some, I've actually written, as I said, a little bit about this, and I got some interest from a couple of small towns, but I no one has created the app. But if you think of these tasks like a bridal registry, these are the set of things that need to be done. And, oh, somebody's already signed up for that one. I don't need to worry about that. I can sign up for something else. It means that we get information about priority, and we solve the free rider problem, and we get rid of government. There's no government involvement in this except as the enforcer of the contract, and that's true for all contracts.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind when we think about Taiwan or when we think about Estonia is also that when the state acts there, like, it's very satisfactory. Like the service just works. And a lot of dissatisfaction, the dissatisfaction, I think, in many Western liberal democracies with the state itself, and I think that's why Doge and others came up, is when you interact with the state, it's long-winded, it is dissatisfaction. Like, it is not like Amazon, right? Amazon is like, I'm doing a click, it delivers to me, great product. But when you interact with the state, especially in a German context, you really despise every step of the process. And that's not the case in Estonia, where now 99% to 100% of the state's functions are even offered digitally. So I think that's a great example of state capacity on a very pragmatic, real-world policy level. Maybe, Mike, I want to zoom out because we're approaching the hour, and I just want to ask you about one thing if we already have you here, and that is going back to your Hegelian intuition that we are in the antithesis at the moment. I have to say the antithesis to a certain degree is self-inflicted, right? As you said, Fukuyama has contributed to it, but it's not Francis Fukuyama himself. It's more the whole movement became intellectually dry. I think you, as me, attend a lot of liberal or libertarian conferences. It's the old same faces that talk about the same old ideas. And it feels intellectually dry. Right? And we encountered that in today's conversation quite a lot, because when I asked you and about the theory of the state, that, or when I, as a political philosopher, have to talk about the theory of the state, we just feel like we are not there. We have not been prepared for this kind of question. And we should be ready. And not many people are doing the job to think about these questions. So it's really intellectually dry these days. Do you drive any hope from any movements that you see? I mean, state capacity is, I think, at least an interesting alley of discourse. So now in the United States, Ezra Klein has published Abundance, which gives a kind of new flavor to something that I think we have had in the classical liberal camp ourselves with Julian Simon and the Cornucopians, very similar to that, the abundance agenda, maybe more linked to real-world public policy. But is there anything that you think is currently relevant that liberals should think about more and are thinking and that you want to highlight?
Well, you said two things. Let me take them in order first. It is important, in fact, essential, that people who listen to this podcast recognize that the key question is to have a theory of the state that allows us actually to make progress, not a last-ditch defense of market perfection, because all of our time has been devoted to that. Stop that. Start saying, here's the way that I don't know what the answer is. I hope that people younger and smarter than I, because it has been dry. And as an old person, I'm responsible for that. The triumphalism of the 90s, the sort of complacency of the 2000s, and then suddenly, wait, what happened? Well, it was because we gave up. We got lazy. And so we need an answer to say, this is what the state should do. It is certainly possible to do that. And I look forward to that happening. The other point that you made is that we're going to have to think of ways to advertise the costs of low cost. One of the things that people want is free stuff. Well, nothing's free. And so what you get instead is queuing or non-price rationing. And many people are very upset about that, and they think of it as government inefficiency. It's a product of the fact that we want free stuff. And so what I have seen in the United States is that there has been an expansion of bureaucratic provision, and I've written about this a number of times. People are upset about surge pricing. Well, if you go to the airport, Starbucks has surge pricing. They keep their coffee the same price, but at certain times of the day, there may be a half-hour line. The cost of anything is the sum of the money price and the time you waste in line. So in bureaucracy, what we have seen is an enormous tax increase. The tax takes the form of inconvenience. So the Adam Smith said that the cost of anything is the toil and trouble of acquiring it. If the trouble of acquiring it is going up because the government is so inefficient, I think that gives us an opportunity to say we need to have alternative provision or not to have that thing at all. In India, they call this the license Raj. And the license Raj is that Indian bureaucrats have recognized they can make a lot of money from bribes by making the system inefficient. Now, I think that's not true in Germany. If you try to bribe a German official, unless it's a whole lot of money, for any small amount of money that would be reasonable, not only will they say no, they will get really angry because it's an offense to their honor. That's stripping away now. More and more bureaucrats in the United States probably are willing to be bribed because the inefficiency means that we're paying with time instead of money. And so the idea that people have that things are free because it has a zero money cost, it's easy to explain that. That's the sort of thing that we can advance along, saying that the cost of anything is the toil and trouble of acquiring it. How easy was it for you to get that new driver's license?
Yeah, I mean, it can have some repercussions, right? And like, just to close that off, I just want to get to your intuition. Like, I always quarrel around one particular question. That is, for example, if I want to renew my passport and I really need it urgently to go and travel for business, right? And some other granny, she also needs to renew the passport, but she doesn't have that particular need to have it urgently done. Now, in a regulatory state like Germany that values individual equality, we would say, well, your number is 571 and the granny is 570. She gets processed first. But if I say, well, I pay $100 or 100 euros in our case to skip the line, how should we deal with that? The German intuition might be, no, we can't buy that. Like, that's the process of the regulatory state. And it treats us equally and in order. And I can't buy myself up there, but it allows for the transactions cost that you are just mentioning. So how should we deal with that in a liberal democracy? Just to close that off.
That is a great question. What's interesting is the question that you raise is the one that gets argued about. The question that should be argued about is, why is it that we have to wait in line in the first place? And the answer is that bureaucrats have budgets for money, but not for customers' time. They don't mind spending customers' time. They do want to cut their own budget. So I'm assigned a certain amount. But suppose you had 500 people waiting in line. If you were able to ask them and solve the transaction cost problem of collective action, would you each pay $5 in order to have two more people hired in order to process driver's licenses or passports? They'd all say yes. So that's, you've just made the argument for state capacity. What we need to do is charge less time and charge higher fees to everyone. And even grandma would be better off. She would prefer to pay 5 euros not to have to wait in line for 2 hours. It doesn't cost very much. If you're talking about processing 20, 30 people an hour, it's easy to pay for one more bureaucrat. But the pressure is always to reduce the money cost. And it's like hydraulics. It's not free. We're pushing the cost over into time. And so what governments need to recognize is that they have an obligation. I think about this often when if I'm driving and three lanes go down to one, and everyone's waiting in line, maybe for an hour. Each of them would be willing to pay a lot. Now, it's really expensive to pay workers to work 24 hours, and so they usually knock off at 6 o'clock. They come back the next morning at 7. All of those people would happily pay the overtime for those workers to work more, but the state is worried about its monetary budget, not the time cost of its customers. Amazon does worry about the time cost of its customers because demand curves slope downward. Amazon knows that if they cut their money price, they'll sell more. They will also sell more if they make their product more convenient. That's not true for passports. You have to have the passport. You're stuck. So it's not true that demand curves slope downward. We get this enormous dead weight losses. So that's the sort of easy win that we can shoot for, is let's reduce the cost of dealing with the government, where the cost is the sum of the money price and the inconvenience.
And I think we should just send that snippet to the German government, because this happened with the migration law that recently passed like 2 years ago. And now all the administration is just overloaded. So the bureaucracy cannot follow steps.
It's only overloaded because they don't have enough workers.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And they call for it. And it's like really dramatic articles in the newspapers. And again, I just wanted to extract that intuition from you, because that's exactly the way to think about it, right? From a staff capacity perspective.
Yeah. But just to end, I mean, with the driver's license, now we have the idea that elderly people need to renew their driver's license on a regular basis to make sure they are fit enough to take part in the traffic.
Go drivers. Easy.
And they still have the same number of bureaucrats, but all the elderly or older people will come because they want to keep their license, right?
This issue almost brought down a government in North Carolina. You cannot get an appointment. You can't get into a driver's license office. You have to make an appointment. It's at least 90 days in advance before you can get this. And a big part of the problem was old people. So they passed this law. We should check old people. Maybe they can't see. Maybe they don't know signs. The result was that it's actually almost impossible now. People will show up in the morning. They'll wait 2 or 3 days sitting in line. And the reason was that the state was reluctant to increase the budget because they wanted efficiency. They were reluctant to increase the budget for the number of people who worked at the driver's license offices. And it is shocking to me that they don't take into account time. So this is a generic problem. All voters will understand it. If that's one of the things that you mentioned, we don't have to make it more like Amazon. What we have to do is recognize that people's time is valuable. If you elect me, I promise I will hire more bureaucrats for all of the rules we do not get rid of. First, I'll get rid of a bunch of rules. But if we don't get rid of them, I'm going to hire more people to process the paperwork that's driving you crazy.
That's a new campaign platform for a libertarian that I haven't heard before, but let's see how it goes. Maybe we have to adjust our tone. First of all, Mike, thanks so much for your time and being so generous with it. We usually have a section where we close out a podcast by asking our guests about a book recommendation. So maybe you have thought about which book would you recommend liberals to read, because they haven't yet read, or it's not in the liberal canon. What would you recommend?
Well, I don't know if this is in the liberal canon or not. It's not in the American liberal canon. It may be in the European, but I have two. Inflation strikes everywhere, but it depends more on your tastes. The first is by Bruno Leone. It's Freedom in the Law, 1961. Now, it is known among a few people, but it's a pretty, only the cognoscenti know that book. It's a remarkable book. It'll change the way that you think about the law and the state, and that he died tragically young, but that book is terrific. Another one is a book.
Bruno Leone, just for our audience, is like one of the grand seigneurs of the European tradition of liberalism, and there's still an institute named after him in Italy.
He is well known among, I think, scholars, but among many liberals, he is not sufficiently known. And so that is a book by someone you may have heard of, but may not have read. And so that I was trying to take your instruction seriously. The other is a recent book from 2024 by a guy named Sean McMeekin, and it's a history of communism. It's called To Overthrow the World, The Rise and Fall and Rise of Communism. And it is the first couple of chapters are a description of the ideas of utopians, and particularly what led to Karl Marx bastardizing Hegel in a way that it's the clearest thing that I've ever read. And then the rest of it is a history of communism that is so insightful. It's actually a page turner. It sounds like it wouldn't, but this is a book that you could easily just read on the train if you're going somewhere this summer. It is a wonderful book. So again, it's Sean McMeekin, M-C-M-E-E-K-I-N, To Overthrow the World.
Perfect. And we will link to that, of course, in our show notes. So thank you, Mike, very much for joining us today. It was a great pleasure. It was good fun. And as usual, I learned tons of stuff and especially new vocabulary that I can instruct the German bureaucratic state with. So thanks, Mike, for joining us and hopefully to see each other soon again in person.
It was a great pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Bye.